Court, please stand. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session. Pursuant to law. Please be seated.
Thank you. At this point in time, we're on record in City of Milton versus Galvan. Matters before the court for oral argument. Victor Villegas on behalf of the City of Milton, on behalf of Mr. and Mrs. Galvan, Scott Magnuson. Any preliminary matters?
No, Your Honor.
You may proceed, sir.
Chief Justice Burdick, members of the Supreme Court, may it please the court and counsel. The City of Milton appeals the District Court's grant of summary judgment, holding that the Galvans established a prescriptive easement, as well as the City appeals the subsequent grant of attorney's fees in this matter. With respect to the grant of summary judgment, the City argues that there were material issues of fact raised during the summary judgment proceedings regarding the Galvans' intent to abandon all farming on their property when seeking to rezone their farm to a subdivision and golf course. Now, the law of abandonment states that when an easement is abandoned, a party must show that destruction of that easement or that its legitimate use has been rendered impossible by some act of the owner hereof. And what the City raised on summary judgment was the fact that the Galvans eliminated the purpose for which that prescriptive easement was. There's no dispute that the purpose of this easement was an agricultural purpose. And so when the Galvans applied to Canyon County to rezone this property, get a comp plan amendment as well as a conditional use permit to turn their farm into a residential subdivision golf course, that at least raised the issue of, is there a material issue fact of whether they've abandoned the use for which that easement was. The District Court held in its memorandum decision, and record page 301, at most, the act of applying for a zoning change indicated that Galvans had a plan for future changes in the use of their property, which would potentially end their use of the easement. However, the City contends, though, that it was more than just the act of applying. There were many examples that the City put forth in the evidence that raised that issue of fact. First and foremost, there's evidence that the Galvans in 1996 submitted their application for zoning amendment. And as part of their application, they submitted an applicant intent form. And in that form, on page 155, there was a question, what changes to the use of land are proposed? The answer was, all farm operations will stop and land will be converted to residential use. And that's on clerk's record, page 155. Thereafter, the Galvans applied a second time in 1997, and this was the comprehensive plan amendment, conditional use permit and rezone. And as part of that application process, Mr. Galvan wrote a letter on January 14th, 1997 to Jerry Jones of Canyon County Planning and Zoning. And he writes, my intent is to convert 260 acres of agricultural and dry grazing ground that borders the north boundary of the city limits of Milton to approximately 120 lots and a 18-hole golf course. The letter concludes with, this ground has been in my family for approximately 122 years. I farmed here for approximately 50 years, and due to my health and age, I no longer have the desire to farm, and I feel that this will be a good transition for the City of Milton and the surrounding area. So by the time that Galvan submitted their application to rezone their property, there was at least a material issue of fact here as to intent. Did they intend to abandon?
You said the Galvins made that application. Is it the Galvins or C&G Inc. that made that
application? C&G Inc., Your Honor, and Mr. Galvin was the owner of C&G.
President of C&G Inc.?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it looks like from the record that in 2012 the land was transferred back from C&G Inc. to the Galvins?
I don't recall, Your Honor.
I think that's in the affidavit of Kathy Skidmore. So when did C&G Inc. start, and when did the land get transferred to C&G Inc.?
Standing here, I don't recall.
Well, maybe that's a better question for Mr. Magnuson.
My apologies.
I don't believe so, Chief Justice.
I think those decisive acts, as we've set forth in our briefing, are all of those purposeful acts that the Galvins took throughout the application process. The district court really looked at it in more of a general sense and said, well, the mere act of just applying for a rezone isn't enough. However, there were several specific acts that we brought up forth in the brief, and it's also contained in the clerk's record. The examples of some of those purposeful acts, they went to the public hearings. They testified on behalf in support of their application. They had to hire a surveyor. And the record shows that the surveyor testified on behalf of the application. There were notice requirements. This is page 173 of the clerk's record. They had to send notice to the city of Middleton, Canyon County Highway District, Middleton School District, Southwest District Health, the sheriff, and neighbors. So there were a multitude of purposeful acts, Chief Justice Burdick, that the city contends would be sufficient.
Is there any evidence in the record post-application that the actual use of the road changed by the Galvins or C&G?
Not that I'm aware of.
So what we have basically is governmental applications and some testimony about possible future development of the land. That's the basis, the sole basis of the abandonment claim?
I don't believe that's the sole basis. That's at least enough to allow the city to get to court. The threshold here on summary judgment was, are there material issues of fact? The city was not required to prove its case in its entirety. That's why the standard is such that the city should have had this opportunity to fully vet this case, to cross-examine witnesses, to conduct further discovery beyond the phase where we ended at that point.
Do you agree that you misstated the standard of review for the trial court's decision?
I don't, Justice Horton. Reading the, and I know that it was raised in the respondent's brief, I know that as to disputed issues of fact, that the trial court is to view the facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. Now, as to uncontroverted...
A misstatement.
I'm sorry?
Certainly in the case of controverted facts, resolution has to go in favor of the non-moving party, but throughout your opening brief, you talked about all reasonable inferences, the entitlement to all reasonable inferences, and isn't it quite clear that the trial court, under these circumstances, is free to arrive at the most probable inferences?
Chief Justice Horton, as to uncontroverted facts, when I wrote the brief, I was looking, citing to the, there's a dispute here that they intended to abandon all farming operations. The Galvins have argued that they did not abandon all farming operations, and so I looked at that as a disputed issue of fact, and under a disputed issues of fact, the court is to view the light in favorable of the non-moving party.
Don't you rely on inferences to draw the conclusion that there was an intent to abandon from the application for rezoning?
Yes, but again, I'm looking at that whether it's an uncontroverted fact or a controverted fact. Certainly, I agree, though, Justice Horton, that the law is, or the standard is, if there's an uncontroverted fact and it's a bench trial, the trial court is allowed to resolve any conflicting inferences. It doesn't have to view one in favor of the non-moving party. But I was citing that in my briefing as to controverted facts.
What was the evidence that the city of Middleton didn't get to put on, that didn't get to the judge to consider?
I don't know at this point, Justice Brody, because part of this is my ability to cross-examine the witnesses. I don't know what the witnesses would have said at this point. I believe that there was additional work to be done on this case. I believe that the threshold on summary judgment to defeat summary judgment at this point was met to raise material issues of fact regarding abandonment. And then we could proceed on to trial where it would be the city's burden to prove that there was, in fact, an abandonment that had occurred.
Is there any request to postpone summary judgment so that additional discovery could be sought?
There was none that was filed. However, Justices, so going back to the material issues of fact, one of the other decisions that the district court made that we feel was really a decision, mixed question of fact and law, was the decision from the district court that there were no other further acts, or there was a requirement that the Galvins needed to take further acts beyond just getting the rezone of their property in order for there to be an abandonment. Now, as I've already touched upon in answering some of the justices' questions, it's the city's position that there were, in fact, more furtherance or acts and furtherance of their intent. And though that furtherance is, again, expressed through not just the mere fact of applying for the application. This was a two-year process that the applicant took to rezone their property. And again, it was through public testimony. It was through written correspondence to planning and zoning, the hiring of professionals, the preparation of deeds, describing the legal description of the property to be rezoned. And so it's the city's position that those purposeful acts, at a minimum, should have raised material issues of fact to preclude summary judgment. Those purposeful acts could be sufficient to find that there was an abandonment of the farming use at the time the rezone was granted. Now, the district court has
looked. Can I interrupt just for a second?
Yes.
About 70 years ago, in a case called O'Brien versus Best, this court held that to constitute an abandonment of an easement, it must be shown that the easement was destroyed or that its legitimate use has been rendered impossible. Do any of these so called facts that the Galvins engaged in, the decisive acts, did any of those render the use of this easement impossible? Or did any of them destroy it?
Justice Bevin, part of the city's argument is, and this is really a question of law possibly for this court, is the grant of that rezone, the grant, the comprehensive plan amendment, and the rezone, is that sufficient to constitute a destruction of the easement, given the fact that the Galvins have represented all farming operations who are going to stop? However, to also answer your question, Justice Bevin, this is why we needed to go to trial, because I don't know what else happened on that farm after that application was granted. Did they begin to cut a road into there? Did they block something? The city of Middleton does not know. We never got to that point on summary judgment. And so I don't know if there were other acts that would have done that. In prepping for this oral argument, I was thinking about that. What would it be? Would it be asking for a building permit? I couldn't find any case law that said that. Doing another paper preliminary plat, would that be enough? Again, I could not find any case law to support that. So I believe it's on a case-by-case basis, and I don't know if there's a bright-line rule or not, but certainly the city's position on that point was, based on the representations, it induced the local government to give them the zoning that they asked for, and they represented.
But that's not, if the government grants the rezone and allows the change, there's certainly no mandatory requirement that the landowner actually change the use of land, right? I mean, they can continue to farm, right, even with the rezone.
I suppose so. I'm not aware of anything that would prohibit them legally to do so. I know that certainly there's the Idaho Right to Farm Act, for example. I mean, I'm a land use attorney, so I'm not going to sit up here, Justice Brody, and say that there's something that would prevent them from doing so. But I'm not aware of any local ordinances or anything that Canyon County had at the time that would prohibit them from doing that. But that's where that present intent and that immediate intent to abandon comes in play, though. At what point did the Galvins decide we're going to continue farming? They made a conscious decision to not just apply for rezone, but to make that unequivocal statement. If this gets approved, all farming operations will stop. Now, in opposition to, or in reply to our memorandum, there was a supplemental declaration submitted by Mr. Galvin. And he explains that due to the economy and due to other reasons, they decided not to implement or to move forward with that intent to do so. But when did that happen? It appears to me it happened after the decision granting the rezone was done. I mean, at some point, their intent changed, and our position is, at that point, was there an abandonment? And if so, did they resume use or a prescriptive use? And if so, then one of the issues that was somewhat touched on, was it a 5-year prescriptive use or a 20-year prescriptive use at that point? And those were certainly other issues that we were not able to delve into.
So does the prescriptive easement run with the land, or does it run to an individual?
It runs with the land, Justice Stegner. It was it's the purpose for which the easement was the agricultural use.
And did the city argue that the Galvins were entitled to a lesser right than a prescriptive easement, but still entitled to something?
No, Justice Taylor, we didn't argue that. The other part of our appeal has to do whether the district court erred in granting attorney's fees. Obviously, if this court affirms the district court's grant of summary judgment, it's the city's position that based on all the reasons that we've already discussed on the summary judgment portion, that the city of Middleton had a reasonable basis in fact and in law in its defense, and that its defense was not frivolous such that attorney's fees should have been awarded against the city. One of the issues we also raised in our briefing had to do with the dimensions of the prescriptive easement. During summary judgment, the city raised that issue that the Galvin's did not set forth any evidence regarding the physical dimensions of the easement. Even after the reply briefs were submitted, there was still no evidence submitted by the Galvin's sufficient to fix the physical dimensions of the prescriptive easement as has been required by decisions of this court when a court is fixing the dimensions in the judgment. Now, after we raised that issue, there was a judgment that was issued, and then the Galvin submitted an amended judgment seeking to include a survey. And we objected to that, and the district court recognized that that information was not included in the initial summary judgment. And that at least should bring attention to the fact that the city was providing a legitimate defense to this this claim, not just with respect to abandonment, but just even questions of fact regarding the dimensions of this easement. As the record shows, the district court commanded the parties to go ahead and submit additional briefing and gave the city an opportunity to dispute the dimensions of that easement, which the city submitted briefing showing its intent to dispute the easement, that the dimensions of the easement. The dimensions of the easement went into the public right-of-way. And so the city set forth its own survey and argued that certainly the survey that was submitted or the dimensions that was submitted by the Galvins was not proper. And we thought, okay, well, there's another issue of fact. We can go to trial on this. And that's when the Galvins, and it was procedural. I had never run into this before, but the Galvins said, okay, well, we still dispute that the city's right on the dimensions, but we're just going to go ahead and accept the dimensions set forth in the city. And again, when we brought up the issue of the dimensions, just like when we brought up the issue of abandonment, the district court had reservations of immediately making a decision, which continued, you know, it resulted in continued hearings. So it's certainly the city's position that we did have a legitimate defense, and this was not a frivolous defense of the case.
You cited Napa Meridian Irrigation District a couple of times in your opening brief in support of the contention that if there's one tribal issue, then it's inappropriate to award attorney's fees.
Yes.
You're aware of the current status of Napa Meridian Irrigation District, I assume.
I believe so, Justice Horton.
Did you shepherdize it?
Not recently.
Are you familiar with our decision, Idaho Military Historical Society versus Maslin?
No, I'm not.
That's the one where we repudiated the one tribal issue concept.
I wasn't aware of that, Justice Horton. So, Justice Ward, even despite the one tribal issue, that we believe, though, that isn't the only tribal issue. Again, the issues raised as to whether there was an issue of abandonment based on the representations from the Galvins would have also been sufficient as well to support a finding that there was a reasonable basis in fact and law in defense of this case. With that, I'm going to reserve any leftover time for rebuttal if I can answer any of the questions.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Anderson.
Good morning, Justice of the Court, Madam Clerk, and Counsel. My name is Scott Magnuson of Barker, Rochelle, and Simpson, and I'm appearing on behalf of the Galvins. Initially, I want to address Justice Stegner's question about CNG. It was not raised below at the trial court level, and I don't have that information about the transferring of any land. But I don't think
it... Just a second. I have a supplemental reply brief in opposition to plaintiff's motion for summary judgment. It says it's now an issue of material disputed fact as to whether the Galvins were the purported owners of the parcel of land at the time of abandonment. According to plaintiff Martin Galvin, C&G Inc. was the owner of the parcel that received BCID irrigation waters. So
okay.
I think it was raised.
Okay, it was raised. When you mentioned Kathy Skidmore's, she works for BCID and provided the information regarding the irrigation water. The issue regarding the easement itself is that once you establish the easement, it attaches to the land as you specified, and it can run with the land, and so it doesn't matter if it's a predecessor and interest that you attach to it or whether the use was either utilized by an agent or a worker of yours, et cetera, et cetera.
So who did own the property during the course of this history?
Well,
it looks like in 2012, the Galvins repurchased it from C&G Inc. It looks like C&G Inc. was the entity that brought the rezone.
Right. The Galvins were the underlying owners back when the easement was established, which was back in 1949.
And I don't think the submissions of the Galvins talked about the change in ownership of the property.
It did not.
And the city seems to have raised that issue, and it doesn't seem to have been addressed by the court in determining whether a prescriptive easement arose. Isn't that an important consideration as to who owned the property and who was claiming the prescription?
In terms of whether it passed or was abandoned or...
Whether it was created.
Whether it was created initially?
Well, it has to be created in the recent past in order for it to be found.
Right.
Summary judgment awarded in 2017 or whenever it was that Judge Southworth granted the prescriptive easement. So I'm trying to find out who owned the property and when did they own the property?
As the real property, real party in interest.
As a real party in interest, the Galvins brought it as a real party in interest currently.
But that depends on who owns the property, does it not?
Yeah, they would, because the easement would be pertinent to that, to the easement and the property, correct. And so they farmed under the C&G, but I believe the Galvins are the real parties in interest that brought this under that.
So when did C&G own the property?
I'm not certain if the property was in C&G's name or when it was transferred exactly.
Well, in the findings of facts and conclusions of law on the rezone, the county commission found that C&G Inc. was the owner. So I assume they owned it in the late 90s. Kathy Skidmore's affidavit says that in 2012 the property was transferred to the Galvins, and I'm trying to figure out who owned it when.
I think that it was correct. It was in or around that time that it was transferred back to the Galvins.
In 2012.
I believe that is correct.
And how long did C&G own it?
I don't have that information.
And isn't C&G...
The C&G is essentially Martin and Pat Galvin. Is their farming operations. Well, they are the members of C&G.
The shareholders of that corporation.
Correct. And
so, but
they've
that's
been
a separate entity.
Right.
And I'm trying to figure out when did they own the property? When did C&G Inc. own this property?
I don't know the exact time. I don't know if it would matter because the establishment of the easement would run with that. And so as long as they're the real party in interest for this particular, at the current time, it would have transferred accordingly. The easement would have, once it was established at the five-year prescription period, which the court found that from 1949, and it essentially has not been used differently, but somewhere in the 1950s, the court decided that that is when the prescription period would have run, and therefore the easement was created at that time. And so once it is created, it could be transferred to, once it's created by a predecessor in interest, because this court has found that you're allowed to tack on, even if you don't have the correct prescriptive period, you're allowed to tack on if you transfer that property, and therefore once you get to whoever the current interest, the real party in interest, they would have that prescriptive right, ultimately.
So you're saying even if C&G owned it during the prescriptive period, that they would get the benefit of any prescriptive use that the Galvins had prior to their ownership?
Correct. Okay. Correct. I think when we discussed abandonment, I think it's interesting to look to see what the prescriptive easement was and the underlying nature of it, because that was not appealed by the City of Middleton. The City of Middleton initially took the position there is no prescriptive right. That is what this case is about, that there was no prescriptive right to use the easement. The issues concerning the width and the length and everything else came after the fact and was brought up at a later time, and I'll address that at a later time. So the underlying prescriptive easement, the court found that the purpose was for maintaining the road and adjacent ditch to travel to and from their farm property, to transport equipment to the farm and to haul crops from the farm. Now, the city disputes the dimensions, but the only evidence that was presented was by declaration by Mr. Galvin, and essentially it was from one end of the property to the other end of the property. And the width was to accommodate a 16-foot combine, and he requested and indicated that his use was, that was the largest piece of equipment, and the use was for roughly 2 feet on either side, and so the total was 20 feet. That's the only evidence that's in the record. It is unchallenged. It was, there was no evidence against it, and so ultimately that's what the dimensions ended up being for the prescriptive easement.
Did the dimensions end up being 16 feet, not 20 feet?
What's that?
Weren't the dimensions ultimately determined to be 16 feet, not 20 feet?
Correct. What occurred is, as Mr. Villegas was mentioning, on the underlying summary judgment motion, the district court did not make findings of fact concerning the length and width of the underlying easement. That information was before the court on summary judgment, prior to the court making its order on summary judgment. What happened is the city filed a motion for reconsideration, and at the same time, I filed a motion to amend the judgment to include that description, because there was unchallenged facts as to the length and width, and therefore, we submitted a survey. Unbeknownst to me, and I did not realize, the survey actually took into consideration a portion of Middleton Road of the public. So the meets and bounds were off a little bit. That's what the city has grasped onto as saying, we have a legitimate defense. The survey's wrong. And so from that point, the judge said, okay, let's look at the meets and bounds. We'll give the city an opportunity if they wish to contest this. The city filed what was a notice to contest description of the easement. It didn't present any evidence. It didn't submit any affidavits. It merely stated that they intended to put on their own survey, their own surveyor, and that they were going to attach a description. They sent that over, and I got a hold of it, and it said 16 feet. And what the Galvins had done at that point, because this is toward the end of litigation, this started back in 2016, simply said, we'll accept this as the survey. We'll accept this to attach to the judgment, to amend the judgment as the proper description. What occurred after that is that the city came in and said, no, we're not going to let you accept this. You have to admit that there was a legitimate issue for trial. And I believe at the hearing, the city is the one that made that representation. I'm not saying it was to me. It was made in courts to the district judge. And at that point, the judge entered the 16 feet and the description that we agreed to stipulate to at that time.
And so what was the purpose of saying, no, you've got to agree that there was a genuine issue of fact? What was, why was the city
underlying
that of the Galvins?
The underlying issue for that was, and I believe this was said in the record too, is the elephant in the room was the payment of attorney's fees. If there was a material issue of fact to raise this defense, to put the Galvins through this process, then the city felt they would not be, there would not be awarded attorney's fees against them. And so that was the only reason from my position. And I believe it was discussed. Because at that time, the district court allowed the city the opportunity to brief whether 12-117 would be applicable in this particular case. And so we had an additional two-week briefing period to discuss attorney's fees at that time. In terms of abandonment of the, so the scope of the easement, realistically what I was trying to get at, the purpose was for maintaining the road, adjacent ditch to travel to and from the farm property, to transport equipment and crops to and from the farm property, et cetera. I want to establish that because in order to know if there was an abandonment of the easement, we have to know what the underlying easement was. As the city points out, in terms of abandonment, there needs to be two elements established. There needs to be an intent to abandon, and it needs to be coupled by a clear, unequivocal, and decisive act constituting abandonment. O'Brien versus Best went further on and said that act could be either destruction, it could be the legitimate use rendered impossible, or some other unequivocal act showing an intention to permanently abandon that particular right. In its briefing, the city cited to, I believe it was Stafford versus Weaver, for the claim that that was equivalent to this case. In the Stafford case, what happened was Mr. Stafford had an original ditch and decided to fill that ditch in and destroy it. And then he decided to move and dig another ditch and utilize that one for irrigation. The court, the underlying court found that Mr. Stafford couldn't establish a prescriptive easement. That was the first thing because the testimony in that case in terms of predecessors of use, like we were discussing earlier, whether they used it, how they used it, and the location of the original ditch was all over the map. And so the court found that they couldn't find a clear description of the underlying easement. The court went further and stated, well, even if, and this was kind of dicta, but even if there was a prescriptive easement, it was considered abandoned because Mr. Stafford had filled in the ditch, essentially destroyed the easement. And therefore, that would have constituted an abandonment because it would have shown a decisive act which shows the intent not to use it before. And I think that's where a lot of the cases are, is that no one goes out and says, I intend to abandon this easement. What happens is there's an act that occurs. Because in Idaho, even mere non-use, you can stop using it, that doesn't evidence an intent to abandon. And so therefore, you need something more. You need that act that destroys the very nature of it, the easement itself. So if he had plowed the road, if he'd done whatever it was, that would show destruction of that easement and for the purpose. The record before the court was that, and it wasn't denied, there was an application to rezone the property, and it occurred from 1996 till it was finally granted in 1998. During this whole time, there is evidence in the record that is unchallenged that the Galvins continued to farm this. There's a declaration from Mr. Mike Wagner, who was the gentleman who's been farming it since the mid-90s, indicating that they continuously farmed it the same, and it's been that way essentially and arguably since 1949. The application for rezoning did show an intent. It showed, I intend to stop farming because I would like to build in the future a golf course and some residential units. That is the act. The city wants this, the court to believe that that is the intent, that is the act, and that is the only thing that shows abandonment. And the bottom line is it's just not enough. Even if you draw all the inferences to that, you can't get abandonment. And I think that's what the court was finding below, is that all these other facts are unchallenged, but even not even considering them, given that fact alone of the rezone and the granting, you cannot get to abandonment of that underlying easement. It doesn't say I intend to abandon the easement. It doesn't say I intend to do anything. There still possibly or arguably is going to be irrigation that comes off of if the golf course was on that side. This rezoning was over 200-plus acres, and the parcel we're talking about is, I believe, 40. And so there's still going to be the ditches and the irrigation necessities and the easements along with that. And so maybe, if anything, if there was even the development, there could have been an argument made in the future that the nature of the easement may have changed. But that doesn't destroy the easement by any means. So I don't think there's any evidence of the intent or there's an act. And that's what the underlying district court found, is that even if you draw the inferences, the burden is on the city to show there's something, and there's just not. I'd like to address the second issue that the city had raised, which is attorney's fees under 12-117. Under 12-117, in any proceeding involving adverse parties, a state agency or political subdivision, and under that statute, a political subdivision is considered a city, the court shall award the prevailing party reasonable attorney's fees, witness fees, etc., if it finds the non-prevailing party acted without a reasonable basis in law or fact. The city makes two real arguments. The first argument is that it had a reasonable basis in fact for its defense. The city argued continuously that it had to defend the suit because the previous adjacent landowners were no longer around to verify the Galvin's claims. Therefore, the city had to bring the suit. Essentially, it begs the question, because what the city is saying is, well, I don't have a defense, and so therefore I need to bring a defense. The prescriptive period started back in 1949. It continuously went through even the present day, because it never stopped. But the city couldn't go, or I don't know if it did or not. I don't know what investigations it did. However, the city did not find any evidence, and therefore it said, well, we had to go to trial. We had to press this case. That was the reasonable basis, in fact, that it said. As stewards, and I believe they say it multiple times, as stewards of the public and the public's trust, we had to push this case forward. The second issue they state is that they had a reasonable basis in law for the defense. And the main argument on that is what they've considered the legitimate issue. And that is the dimensions of the easement. That is the 16 feet versus 20 feet. And in the underlying record, they do not produce any evidence that is controverting our evidence of the 20 feet. We simply stated at the very end, because of, call it litigation fatigue, we'll accept your 16 feet.
Wasn't there a reference to a statement made by Mr. Galvin to the mayor about 16 feet being claimed?
Correct. What the city put on is that they said, we intend to refute your evidence by putting on testimony by the mayor of Middleton that he recalls in a city meeting Mr. Galvin claiming he had a 16-foot easement, is what it was. He put on a notice to produce evidence, but he didn't put on any evidence. It wasn't in a declaration. It was, I intend to call this person who shall testify that he recalls the Galvin saying something in a city meeting concerning that. In response to that, I did attach, and it's in the record, I did attach the minutes of the meeting that goes through Mr. Galvin's testimony about the history of the easement, about his use of the easement, and the nature of it. It doesn't say anything about the 16 feet in the record, but I also thought it was very useful because it showed that prior to filing a lawsuit, the Galvins went to their city council, they went to their mayor and said, hey, I have this right, you guys are acquiring it, I want you to respect my right, are you going to allow me to continue to utilize my right? I'm glad you guys are purchasing this. The Galvins were actually the biggest supporters because they were having trouble with the adjacent landowners, and so they went to the council meetings, they expressed the joy for the city to acquire this property. But they also said, these are my rights, this is how I've used it, are you going to respect them? And so I think that that issue more aptly points to that rather than saying that there was any evidence in the record. But that was what you're referring to in the 16 feet. I want to point to the case that I mentioned in the brief, which is Morgan versus New Sweden Irrigation District and also Turner versus Cold Springs. And in that case, they held that, this court held that an easement's width is generally a factual question, but when only one party presents evidence of the width, there is no genuine issue of material fact and summary judgment is proper. And so I think that alone, shows the city didn't produce anything. They wanted time. This case was filed in 2016. We went through a round of summary judgment in January thereafter. On the first summary judgment, the court did struggle with the abandonment claim because it was a conclusory statement. Hey, there was an abandonment. What the court did at that time said, well, there's still time for summary judgment. I anticipate there might be a motion for a temporary injunction because we're coming up upon the irrigation season. And so we continued the summary judgment hearing, and the district court said, go get your evidence. Come back with something. Bring me something to show. And we did submit additional evidence, the declaration of Kathy Skidmore and some of the irrigation records. But the city didn't come back with anything, and they still haven't come back from anything. So I don't know where this additional time or evidence that they needed and they claim they need to go to trial with, but there's just no issue of fact in this case. And so I think the underlying judge made the correct decision when it granted summary judgment in favor of the Galvins, and further found that the city's actions exemplified the purpose for 12-117. And the district court said it was clear the Galvins placed the city on notice prior to the action by claiming the easement in city meetings. There's ample evidence of historical use and affidavits that went uncontested. The city failed to acknowledge evidence of Galvin's continuous use while still arguing abandonment. The city failed to present any evidence or contest dimensions prior to summary judgment. Then the city offered the Galvins a description with a 16-foot easement width, and then when the Galvins agreed, they refused to stipulate to their own description. And that summarizes what has occurred in this case, and therefore I think that's the reason that the district court got it wrong and did not err in granting attorney's fees pursuant to that statute. The only last issue I have for the court is that the Galvins are requesting attorney's fees additionally on appeal pursuant to 12.117. Actually, let me take that back. One of the issues that the city raised on the underlying issue and failed to recognize is the fact that 12.117.2 also allows for a partial award of attorney's fees. The city was taking the position that it was an all or nothing stance on the award of attorney's fees, and the court didn't necessarily address 12.117.2, but that subsection states that the court can look at the case and pull out certain sections and award attorney's fees pursuant to that to the prevailing party. And in essence, that's kind of what the district court did, because the final amount awarded, the district court took out what it considered to be the fees for the meets and bounds description that the Galvins had placed into evidence, and took out the work for that extra, for those fees and costs, because there was the description did go lengthwise into Middleton Road, which we pointed out to the underlying court too, is we never claimed to have obviously an easement over the public road. It was an error. So lastly, the Galvins requesting fees on appeal pursuant to 12.117 if they're found to be the prevailing party. In pertinent part, I guess, the city has continued to rely on these same arguments. And this court has found that if you continue to rely on the same arguments used in front of the district court, and you don't provide anything additional that's persuasive or bring into doubt the existing law, then costs and fees are appropriate. And also, the duality of 12.117, this court has said, is to deter this type of conduct from an agency, the city, a political subdivision, and to provide an appropriate remedy for citizens, just like the Galvins, that have borne basically an unfair and unjustified financial burden to essentially protect their rights or to get this done. And so I think this is a case that warrants it, and therefore we ask for costs and fees on appeal as well. So if there's any other questions.
Appear to be none. Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you.
How much time is the comment time?
5 minutes, sir.
Justice, I want to address the portion of our brief regarding 12.117 and the fact that the city had a reasonable basis in fact. And that is one of the issues I didn't discuss, but it certainly was discussed by respondents, and I do want to respond to that. It is the city's position. Given the totality of the facts, the undisputed facts are there was a fight between the Galvins and the predecessor to whom the city obtained this property. Not once was there ever a quiet title action or a claim that there was a prescriptive easement filed against that person. Take that coupled with the fact that there were the unequivocal statements to Canyon County that all farm operations would stop. Look at that along lines that we also have the individuals who the Galvins were claiming the prescriptive easement against, Delno and Hazel Robinson, they passed away. So what the city has is a statement from an individual saying, I've done this entire time. The law and the policy of this state is that prescriptive easements are disfavored, which is why it's the highest burden in the civil context of clear and convincing evidence that the party alleging the prescriptive easement has to show all of the elements necessary to obtain that, including the dimensions of that easement as well. Mr. Magnuson stated that and also read off a portion of the district court's brief that the city did not provide any evidence challenging the dimensions of this prescriptive easement. If the court were to look at the briefing in this on summary judgment, our opposition brief raised, I think it was probably the first point, that there's material issues of fact as to the dimensions of this because there was no evidence submitted by the Galvins regarding the dimensions. Now, when the district court commanded the parties to go back and brief certain issues, those were issues that I understood regarding the issue of abandonment. That's why the district court had at least pause at that point to say, well, I need a little more briefing on abandonment. Snuck into an affidavit at the very last part, and which is what Mr. Magnuson is citing to, is the portion of the supplemental declaration of Mr. Galvin where he says that the header of the combine, the width of the combine was, I believe it was 20 feet. That's not sufficient enough to prepare a judgment with a meets and bounds description of the easement. That is the reason why the Galvin submitted, after the judgment was entered, a motion to amend the judgment to add an additional survey in there. And the district court correctly recognized that that was not evidence that was submitted on summary judgment.
Why do you say that it was snuck in an affidavit?
Because my understanding of the scope of the briefing, Justice Brody, was we were supposed to be briefing the issue of the intent to abandon. Because after we've supplied our opposition brief, there was a reply brief submitted, and yet again in that reply brief, there's no mention whatsoever of the dimensions of the prescriptive easement. After our opposition brief even raised that as a material issue of fact.
So what about the notion that the city wouldn't stipulate to the, wouldn't allow the Galvins to stipulate to the 16-foot easement without making the concession that basically the city had a rational basis for its conduct in this case?
Correct, Justice Brody. The city took that position in order to preserve its rights, first of all, on appeal. But secondly, it was to illustrate to the court that there were issues, that tribal issues still. And this is where I alluded to in my initial oral argument to this court, is I'd never heard or been involved where the court says, well, go ahead and just file something that says you want to dispute the dimensions. And so we did so, but I don't even believe that even constitutes sufficient evidence to still fix something. There was no testimony. We just said this is what we intend to dispute, is the dimensions that the Galvins are asking for is incorrect. And if it were correct, then there would have been no reason for us to challenge those dimensions. And again, we don't even see those dimensions until the Galvins attempted to insert that into the amended judgment. I have about a minute and a half left. Are there any questions I can answer for the court?
None. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Matter is now under advisement. We'll render a decision.
Please stand.